Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, where we talk journalists and journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Sharon Davis. And a word of caution before we begin. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are respectfully advised that today's program may contain the names of people who have died. On the weekend, tens of thousands of Australians came together as Black Lives Matter protests took place around the globe. The catalyst was the terrible and tragic death of George Floyd in the United States. George Floyd died after a police officer pinned him to the ground and held a knee against his neck for almost 9 minutes as he pleaded, "I can't breathe." After the confronting footage of his death was broadcast worldwide, the officer was charged with murder. Like many people around the world, Australians were appalled by this callous and seemingly indifferent murder of an unarmed black man. And for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, George Floyd's death had a particular resonance. 5 years ago, Dungari man David Dungay Jr. died in Long Bay Jail after being held face down by 6 prison officers. His last words, "I can't breathe." In David's case, there were no global protests and there have been no prosecutions. His family says they're still waiting for justice. It seems that we often know more about police and prison violence and race discrimination in the US than we do in our own backyard. Is there a conversation Australians should be having about our own racial injustices? And is our media properly reflecting this back to us? To help us in this important discussion, we're lucky to be joined by 2 fearless journalists, both under difficult recording conditions. Lorena Allam is descended from the Gamilaroi and Yawalare nations of northwest New South Wales. She's the Guardian's Indigenous Affairs editor. She's also been head of Indigenous radio at the ABC. Amy Maguire is a Dhurrumbal and South Sea Islander journalist and broadcaster. She's been the editor of the National Indigenous Times and Tracker magazine and was a former NITV National News political correspondent. Amy joins us from her home in Queensland with a young child in tow. Amy and Lorena, welcome. Is it fair to say that we often know more about police violence and race discrimination in the US than we do here? Lorena, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely true that wider mainstream Australia knows more about what goes on in America and has more empathy, I think, for people who are experiencing this level of police violence. They seem to be extremely reluctant to look in their own backyard, because if they did, they'd find that the situation here is much worse for First Nations people than it is for African Americans. And while we don't want to play that game that sort of people call the oppression Olympics, but it's certainly a fact, and it's certainly been borne out in, you know, any number of investigations, inquiries and reports over decades.
Oh, no, I definitely agree and echo that, because, I mean, I think it's just obvious that Australians are more likely to be outraged by events happening overseas, and that's obviously, you know, because of distance. But also I think it's obvious, a deliberate erasure of the experience of Aboriginal people. I think that's definitely true. And I think we see it in obviously the fact that there's no outrage greeting the deaths of Aboriginal mob over here. And I always think of it's very comparable to the Native American experience and the silencing and the erasure of the Indigenous population over in America. Because I've actually seen statistics where they have higher rates per population of incarceration, but also police brutality. And I think we just see it in the numbers that turn up to protests before the recent historic protests on the weekend. Like, we just never used to get the same level of interest. So I think that's definitely true.
Do Black Lives Matter in Australia?
They matter to us. I'm not sure how much they matter to the rest of Australia, though. I mean, it was wonderful to see so many people turning out in support and marching and wanting to know more, wanting to be good allies, whatever that really means. That's all really encouraging. But we know for a fact that institutionally black lives don't matter. We know that just by the sheer numbers of our people who are going into custody, and who are dying there of absolutely preventable things. I mean, in the case of Aunty Tanya Day, the police locked her up because she was intoxicated and said it was for her own good. Now, how is it that no officer is being held personally responsible for having done that? How is it in her best interest to suffer a fatal head injury in a police cell because she was intoxicated on a train? That doesn't happen to white people in this country. And that is what we talk about when we say Black Lives Matter. That stuff is absolutely preventable. And it is absolutely the fault of systemic racism. And that's what needs to change.
Amy, I think you described it in an article for the Saturday paper last weekend as a national silence. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I think there's been a silence around violence perpetrated against Aboriginal people since the very beginnings of the invasion, and that was very deliberate. And so what I mean is, I mean, I think it's the very purpose of prison in a way and why we have such high rates of black jailing rates as well, because it's about containment. It's about keeping you out of sight. It's about making you invisible. And there is a silencing around what is actually happening to mob. And we see that in the way that different forms of violence are actually illuminated. So you'll see often in the media, and we've seen it just in the past week, people start talking about, oh, but what about black on black crime? Or what about violence in communities? With no sort of form of the historical context at all. And that just serves to deflect and make invisible again the forms of state-sanctioned violence that led to the death of people like David Dungay Jr., like Aunty Tanya Day, like Rebecca Ma, like Miss Jew, like Mr. Ward. All of these levels of violence perpetrated not just at the end of their lives, but throughout their lives are made invisible. And that's what I mean by a silence. And I think, you know, I am actually just in a way outraged at the shock when non-Indigenous Australians say, well, we didn't know about this. We didn't know about Joyce Clark. We didn't know about Mr. Walker. And I just think, well, how can you not know? You know what I mean? Like, we all know. Mm. So I just, I'm sort of, and it's always, the onus is always on Aboriginal people to break that silence. You know what I mean? And it's just been constant since the very beginning. So there definitely is a national silence in this country.
It's true. Historically, the police were the agents of oppression and massacring. So, you know, it was really common, more common than not, for government forces and police officers to be involved in the mass killings of our people over a century. And then police were actively involved under protection legislation in removing our kids. So you can see that this is a deeply toxic relationship where police have been used to eradicate Aboriginal people since the beginnings of colonisation.
Lorena, you've consistently reported on black deaths in custody at both The Guardian and before that at the ABC. But do you think that part of this national silence can be targeted at the media? Do you think there's been enough focus by other media on these things?
No, I don't. I also want to acknowledge the work of Amy McGuire and other First Nations journos who do this work and have done this work year in, year out for a really long time. There's a lot of Indigenous media who work very hard to maintain focus on this issue. In terms of the broader mainstream media, no, there's not a huge appetite for these sorts of stories. And often when they are reported, they are reported with an appalling lack of context or with a particular spin in mind. And while I don't really want to go down this path too much other than to say that we saw a really good example of that in the last few days where there's been reporting that is factually incorrect, that seems to be designed to want to diminish and minimise the true extent of deaths in custody for no other purpose than to offer a deflection or maybe to offer comfort to white people who feel uncomfortable being faced with these truths. I think that a lot of the media reporting is quite racist and irresponsible. I mean, it's well past time that when you have a panel conversation about important issues facing Aboriginal people, you include Aboriginal voices on those panels. It's not okay anymore to continue to just have white people making, you know, their opinions felt, what they think. You need experts who understand, as Amy has written really well in the past, the historical context for all of this and to give you some facts. I think that's what needs to change.
We had a particular example of that on the weekend, I think, at The Insiders, where it was an all-white panel talking about the protests that took place on the weekend.
I think that's very true. Everything that Lorena just mentioned, and I would agree that media has been it's in the way they report these issues. I find that they often privilege the police accounts. Even before, I mean, even on the day that people have died, they privilege police accounts. And I think that's a fundamental problem. I think some individual journalists need to be called out, but I think it's a fundamental problem of the structure of media and the way we report as well, because I think it often does the service of those in power. And for many journalists, their experience is more aligned with that of the police than an Aboriginal person living in an outing community, living in a regional area. You know, like, so they're more likely to believe the witnesses that they or the informants that more closely resemble their experience. So I think it shows, it points to a structural problem in media where we don't have diversity. And we saw that in the insiders panel and the fact that we can continually have white journalists speaking for us. It's never called out. And I think this coming week is the first time that we'll actually have an Aboriginal journalist, Bridget Brennan, on the insiders panel. So I think it says it all. It's a structural problem, a deep problem with the way media is set up. The fact we don't have, only recently we've had a lot of Aboriginal journalists in the mainstream, you know, like largely it has been, you know, the grounding of Aboriginal media who've done a lot of this work. So it's only been recently that even mainstream has opened up to allow Aboriginal voices, you know. So I think it points to a real fundamental problem with the way the media actually stands today.
The diversity issue is a massive structural problem, particularly at our public broadcasters. I mean, Amy's right when she says that it's only recently that we've had a lot of journos in the mainstream. But there are a lot of people, there are a lot of Indigenous people behind the scenes who fought very, very hard for that to be possible. Those people should be acknowledged as well. I think it's great that insiders have listened to public criticism about this, but it's not the first time it's happened, and I hope that it will be the last. But you know, I think the structural issues are that a lot of journos belong to a particular economic class and a particular ethnic background, and that makes their capacity to see a story from lots of different angles quite limited. So I also want to shout out to Indigenous media who do this work, important work on the daily, talking to our mob about issues that matter to them. And I think that is a form of our media that really is really precious, really important, and is woefully underfunded. So, you know, I think if people want to get educated on Indigenous matters, they could also turn to Indigenous media.
Lorena, 2 years ago, The Guardian and yourself, you know, as a big driver of this, put together a database called Deaths Inside that documented the number of Indigenous deaths in custody in, I think, just a bit more than the last 10 years. Why did you put that database together?
We had a question that we couldn't get answered by any jurisdiction, which was how many Aboriginal people have died in custody since the Royal Commission in 91. Those statistics are kept, but they are kept in really scattered environments, or they are kept, they're a bit out of date because the Institute of Criminology has very, strict sort of methodologies around the release of figures, and quite often will only count a death in custody after a coronial process has been completed. So we knew that there were a lot of cases where people were waiting years for their cases to come before a coroner and then to receive a decision. So we thought those numbers were possibly an underestimation of the true size of the problem. So we decided to do a count, and we quickly realised that going all the way back to 1991, doing this the way we wanted to, was just beyond us. So we chose a 10-year period from 2008 to 2018, which was the year we started, and we counted all Aboriginal deaths in custody over that 10-year period. And for a 5-year period, we counted all non-Indigenous deaths in custody as well, so we could find we had enough of numbers to provide a statistical comparison. And then, because it is not about numbers, we wanted to tell the stories of each and every one of those Aboriginal people who had died in custody and tracked what it was they died of, so we could measure things like whether they got the treatment they deserved, whether the coroner's inquest had been completed, whether the families had raised issues about the results or about the process, whether anyone was held to account, how many recommendations were made by which coroner, those sorts of data points. And then when we published the front, the public-facing data, database, We want every square on that database is a person. And we told a little bit of their story as it was, you know, based on the primary sources that we read. So, and we didn't use people's names unless the families gave us express permission to. And we put the database behind you have to opt in. And there's a bit of a warning on the front that says, you know, there's some really distressing material in here. Just we were really mindful all the way through that while this is a really confronting project, and God knows it broke my heart, we also wanted people to know that they, you know, that they were opting in to read some pretty full-on material.
And what did you find when you were doing that particular survey across all of these deaths? Were there things that really stuck out at you about the system and the system's failures?
Yeah, so in more than half of the cases, Aboriginal people who died in custody weren't convicted or charged of a crime, and most of them were on remand. They died of preventable medical procedures, and this is important because a coroner will often say that someone died of natural causes, but we know reading the coronial reports that is a gross misrepresentation of what's happened to them in their lives in the lead up to their incarceration and the treatment they received in custody. We found that in most cases, the government failed to follow their own procedures, that Aboriginal people died needing medical care that wasn't provided. And we found that Aboriginal women were less likely to receive care that they needed than Aboriginal men. So some pretty appalling statistics there.
So there were these major things that you saw in there. Was there any difference from what a Royal Commission saw when they were looking in deaths in custody?
No, not at all. In fact, the fact that there is no difference is even more appalling because that was 30 years ago. And, you know, in 1991, I was a baby journo, so you can do the maths and work out how old I am now. And one of the first stories I did was I went out to Walgett with the Royal Commission when the late Bob Blair was council assisting. And I covered the hearings of the Royal Commission in Walgett. So to read coronial reports that were almost identical to the ones that we heard back then was profoundly depressing because, no, not much has changed. In fact, on many indicators, things are worse. And given that governments have been made aware for decades what they need to do to keep people out of custody and have chosen not to act on those recommendations, these numbers are even more appalling.
And it had to do with what she said about Aboriginal women. I think the only potential difference that might be, I mean, maybe it's not, but I think with the Royal Commission, they didn't really focus on gender, and that was a big failing at the time in relation to the Royal Commission. And it's been something that's been criticised by Aboriginal scholars like Professor Megan Davis. And I think there is a bit of a change in relation to that. We are focusing a lot on the very specific issues that affect being both Aboriginal and a woman in custody. And we saw that with Annie Tony Day's case, with Miss Jew's case and Miss Ma's case and all the, you know, and some of those, as Lorena was saying, are very similar to some of the cases of the women. There was 11 Aboriginal women who died in custody whose cases were investigated by the Royal Commission. We never spoke about those women. You know what I mean? Those women never made the front page of papers. So I think that might be the change that we need in relation to looking specifically also at the intersections of gender and race and class, which may have been a failing of the Royal Commission. But I think that's what is important when you read the Royal Commission documents. We have this groundswell of information that's already been done, has largely been ignored. And a lot of the information is in the individual deaths reports.
This is really, really significant. And that is that when Aboriginal women go into the custody system, whole families are blown apart by that. And we have a massive problem in this country of our kids going into out-of-home care in increasing numbers. And there's a direct line between the kids in out-of-home care and our women in the justice system. And then they are more likely, and they are more at risk of ending up in the criminal justice system from being in out-of-home care. There's a clear link there where women need to be kept home with their families. A lot of Aboriginal women are in jail now for matters to do with really minor offences like unpaid fines or domestic violence, you know, issues that have come from them fleeing domestic violence. So this is a huge unexplored area. And I think in terms of the media, I mean, it's not like there hasn't been enough good reporting and studies done. The most recent one was by Professor Davis called Family is Culture, looking at the out-of-home care system in New South Wales and how it is manifestly failing Aboriginal kids, over 1,000 of them that she studied. But there is a strong link between women going into prisons and the destruction of Aboriginal families.
And I think the rates of incarceration of Indigenous women has gone up more than any other prison population group in the last 10 years as well.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, over the past decades, we've seen huge rates of Aboriginal women being incarcerated. And it's right. I mean, when you tear out Aboriginal women from the community, you're tearing apart so much. You're taking apart so much strength that's within community, and you're ripping apart families. And that's the really traumatizing aspect of incarceration, is just it rips apart Aboriginal families. And I think that's what's happened from the very beginning. Like, looking at it historically, that was a key deliberate tactic, because when you rip apart a family, I mean, what else do you have? You really rip out the foundation of so many generations, you know what I mean? So I think that's been one of the really horrific things that have come out of over the past 30 years, is just how many Aboriginal women we jail. And as Lorena said, with minor crimes, you look at what Aboriginal women are in jail for, and honestly, I don't think the majority, I don't even think probably all Aboriginal women should be in jail, because you look at them and, you know, a lot of them are victims of violence. We saw of Jodie Gore over in WA, she was given this huge sentence for retaliating against her abuser. And so I really believe that, you know, we really have to look at Aboriginal women and the jailing of Aboriginal women as an issue, because if you look at it, you see just how problematic it is.
Lorena, I want to draw your attention to an article that was written yesterday in the Financial Review by their senior reporter, Aaron Patrick. And in it, he challenged the numbers that you had in the Deaths Inside database in relation to deaths in custody. Do you want to respond to that?
We counted them. The numbers existed. We brought them all together and, you know, very carefully counted. We think that number is an underestimation, number one. Number two, the Financial Review has since printed a correction because they accepted that the numbers that they quoted from the Institute of Criminology were actually incorrect. They had only counted cases where people had died in prison custody, not police custody, so there was an error of fact that they corrected. There are many other issues that I have and that other people have with that article that are, you know, gross misrepresentations of what coroners had said, and other issues to do with particularly the section describing David Dungay's death. And I think a number of people have called the reporter out on those. I think that there will be some complaints laid to the press council. Using the term Aborigine, for example, it's been a while since I've read that, to be honest. It seemed a bit, it reminded me of the kind of takes that I used to read 15, 20 years ago. But I also think that what Amy said earlier about the structural issues in the media are apparent in that article. I think that, you know, having not spoken to the reporter, I think it's very easy to wander in and have a take about this stuff without context and without historical knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I would so totally agree with that, because as an Aboriginal journalist, I just can't imagine coming into an issue like this and thinking you know everything. When you know, like, I think it's very characteristic of a lot of non-Indigenous journalists coming into this area, thinking they can look at these facts and see it divorced from everything else and think they know better than people who have been reporting on this issue for years and years and years, and not just journalists, but lawyers. Aboriginal people themselves with lived experience of police brutality. The fact that he can come in and think he can look at these facts and present them in a totally wrong, distorted way. I mean, from the very first sentence, David Dungay didn't die because he was black. He died because of a biscuit. I mean, it's just absolutely, I mean, that's totally wrong in a nutshell. But there's so many images that he uses of David Dungay that are just absolutely disgraceful. I mean, they're all deficit language, as if he never had they call him wretched. And I think the last paragraph is what set it all for me about the piece. And he said in the last paragraph, ultimately, though, Dungay was killed by his poor health, Lee ruled. His heart gave way under stresses and men responsible for his care tried to save him from himself. A sadly appropriate analogy for the state of black and white relations in Australia today. So I think that said it all about how racist this article is. He's basically saying that, white Australia is trying to help these poor black people, but they just keep fighting against it. You know what I mean? It's this myth of white benevolence that is so apparent in Aboriginal affairs and the way white Australia paternalistically looks down at us. And Dungay wasn't killed by his poor health. He was killed by the violence of the justice system. And you see that in the nurse who put that sedative in him and the guards who then, you know, pushed themselves down on him. So I just find it really unbelievable that he can look at the facts of the Dungay case and say that it was just because he wanted a biscuit, it was his poor health. I mean, that just shows exactly how you make invisible the actual violence that's perpetrated against Aboriginal people. And it's shown in the fact, you know, like, why is this man writing this article when he has no background in this issue, you know? And why is it supported by a paper like the Australian Financial Review? Like, I just think it's such a deliberate... I mean, there's even just facts wrong about the fact... 90% of the Royal Commission's recommendations were implemented. It's just wrong. That's a flat-out lie. So I just want to know why this article now, you know, after we had record crowds coming out over the weekend, why? Why have you decided to write this article? The motivations behind it are what interests me. And I actually think it's a deeply racist article.
Can I just add for the record, David Dungay was held down by 5 officers from the IAT and administered an emergent sedative after he'd said 12 times that he could not breathe. Now, even the coroner, in delivering his findings, considered that that was the reason why he died and recommended that the nurse in that case be possibly, you know, have their standards examined by the nursing review board. So to have that kind of assessment, to diminish a life to such in such a way is really disrespectful to the family. And we spent a lot of time with the Dungay family from before the inquest, you know, leading up to the coroner's inquest and then the 2 years of that long and drawn out process. And now, you know, we're still following them today. And to have David's life reduced to that, it really exemplifies how little Black Lives Matter when you can still read something in a newspaper that does dehumanize us like that.
Well,
you know, this man was loved. He has a loving family. They are trying their best to get justice for him, and they have come up against some of the most appalling neglect.
432 deaths, Lorena, and not one prosecution. Why is that?
Oh, it's the million-dollar question, and it's also the most obvious question. The obvious answer is there's no willingness in the system to prosecute. Prosecution often happens because it's in the public interest. There's a number of reasons why a DPP would investigate a death in custody, and public interest is one of them. So there hasn't been a public interest. Quite often, there's no pressure to bring people to account, for individuals to account for their actions. I mean, one of David's aunties outside the inquest on the day that the decision was handed down said they just recommended more training for the guards. How much more training do they need to stop killing us? That's a question for the state and territory corrections and police departments to answer. They have had enough training. So, it's apart from systemic racism, what else do you think it is?
I'd like to try and end this conversation on a positive note. A lot of people have been buoyed by the size of the protests, both here and overseas. Some of the protests on the weekend were the biggest we've ever seen. Do you sense that a change is happening?
Certainly these are bigger and they're different. I'm still thinking about how they are different. But ultimately, I think being in the street matters because it puts public pressure on the institutions that need to change. We have a moment now where things are changing. I would say to people that they can't turn away now. People who marched for Black Lives Mattering in the streets non-Indigenous people have to maintain the course now. They need to keep up the pressure on their own institutions to make the changes that we have been telling governments for decades need to happen, big and small, and from the obvious to the deeply structural. So really simple things like bail reform. So our mob aren't going into jail for traffic offences and unpaid fines. We know that people die in jail on remand. We need to decriminalise certain, we need to decriminalise shoplifting, for example. That should be a civil process. Just to, simple, the reduction, the repealing of summary offences. Public drunkenness, decriminalising public drunkenness. Repealing mandatory sentencing. Giving judges and magistrates greater options in sentencing. And for the sentencing to involve communities, and it's directed towards justice reinvestment rather than, punitive locking people away. So, I think if people want to see change, they have to keep advocating for it. They can't just, go back to normal life now. It has to sustain public pressure as a way to bring change.
Thanks to Lorena Allam and Amy Maguire for joining us remotely. And thanks for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you're subscribed to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Sharon Davis, and thanks for listening.